Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 21 of NML Crossing, where we got us a pretty big show today. A pretty long show, I think. A show that I actually wasn't completely sure I'd be able to have scripted by today. I'm generally a few days ahead in my scripting. And pardon my voice, I think allergies are starting to hit here. I don't know if it's unseasonably warm here, but it's like we were almost at 80 degrees yesterday, and we're not even out of January yet. That kind of sucks. But anyway, I wasn't sure I'd be able to get this one out because of what I included in the back end of this episode, which we'll get to. And I think some of us might find it interesting. I'm gonna get all the comic chatter out of the way first, in case you don't care about that. You could just shut it off if you're just following for the story. But let's get into it here, because we do have a lot to talk about. Today we're going to be covering Detective Comics number 722, which had a June 1998 cover date. The story is called Statistics, written by Chuck Dixon, with the pencils by Jim Aparo, inks James Hodgkins, colors Gloria Vasquez and Android Images, letters John Costanza, edits Peterson and Vincenzo, cover price $1.95. Now we open with a little girl lost. She's holding a rag doll and is desperately searching for her mother in the post-quake Gotham streets. She asks some fellow travelers for help, but, I mean, sadly, everybody's got their own stuff to worry about right now, so, like, she's kind of just yelling into the wind here. Nobody's paying her any attention. Not even the emergency services workers seem all that interested. I mean, she's still upright, she's not bleeding, she's conscious, so they've got other things to worry about. Thankfully for her, Batman and Robin are nearby and they hear her cries. Robin suggests that it might be better if he were the one to approach her, lest Batman, you know, scare the bejesus out of her. So Robin swoops on in to offer a hand, and he assures the girl that he'll do whatever he can to help her be reunited with her mommy, and he'll also try to find her a place to live. Now, her house was a casualty of that very bad thing that happened at 703. Now, Robin drops her off at the GCPD HQ with a note addressed to Detective Renee Montoya. It says that the child's name is Jayreen Gilbert, and basically, just keep an eye on her until he can track down her family. It's signed with a little bat emblem, so Montoya knows this really ain't anything to F around with. Now, the detectives, it turns out, they're quite the paternal and maternal bunch. Jayreen is given a stale donut and some advice from Bullock not to say anything without a lawyer. This gets a giggle from our gal, and me, and an eye roll from Renee. I thought this was a cute little scene. Really shows a softer side to stodgy old Bullock. Now, out on the streets, tensions are starting to, well, I guess continue to bubble over and rise. We check in on a sea of humanity with one fella in particular kvetching about how they've been, you know, standing in lines to get food, to get water. They're just kind of standing in line all the time. We also learn here that it's, we're about 2 weeks removed from the quake. So Gotham's been decimated for, I think, is that a fortnight? Is 2 weeks a fortnight? Or is that a score? I don't know. Anyway, an old lady pretty much tells the dude to shut his stupid mouth. Like, they're all in the same boat, you gotta deal with it. She all but calls him a whiny bitch, which really gets the crowd whipped up in laughter at the poor complainer. Meanwhile, Batman's attempting to batline from building to building, but, well, the buildings aren't in the best of condition, so he, you know, they're falling apart. He falls from a roof and lands with a thud. So this is a new world for the Batman. It kind of reminds me of that time Spidey went to the suburbs. Scene shift, back over to the GCPD HQ, where we check in with the commish. Now he's holding and gazing at a framed photo of Sarah Essen, when little Jayreen wanders in and asks who the pretty lady is. He tells her that it's his wife, and that he doesn't know where she is. And I hate to be that guy, even though I'm always that guy, but you really mean to tell me that Hardbach didn't, I don't know, tell the commissioner that she was okay when he got back from doing whatever he was doing over in Azrael number 40? I don't know. Anyway, speaking of Sarah, how about we finally check back in on her? We find out she's up in Tricorner trying to get the waterworks man to release some water from the reservoir so that the people of Gotham can have some fresh, clean water. Dude's a reasonable guy. Well, not really. He refuses. He's like, no, I'm not doing that. Don't know why he wouldn't do that, but he won't. And so, Sarah reintroduces herself. She says, you know, she tries to make sure that this nitwit knows that she is a police captain. And she's currently the highest-ranking city official in the borough. To which, he still refuses. He's like, no, make me. So she places him under arrest. And at this point, he finally comes around to the idea and gets to flip into proper switches. Back in the streets, dog-led rescue teams are still uncovering bodies. And again, we are 2 weeks out from Quake Day, so one would have to assume that most of their discoveries, if any, are going to be quite grim. Batman watches the emergency crews do their thing for a bit. Back at the GCPD HQ, Jayreen is catching some Z's when Robin pops in for a visit. And she asks him if he can fly like Peter Pan, and he says, oh man, I wish I could. He also asks some questions about Jay's mom, and comes to learn that she's been hanging around with some dude named Shaky, which totally sounds like a dude who'd be on the up and up, right? It also sounds like kind of a pun, given the quakey circumstances that we're currently under. Now Robin tells her to go back to sleep, and he assures her that he is still hard at work on the case. Back outside, we get a cutaway with an armed truck rolling down the ruins of a road, blaring that the curfew is now in effect, and that anybody caught breaking it will be detained. Robin checks back in with Batman, who's having a pretty slow night. He says that the National Guard, they're pretty much taking care of all the looters, so I guess he's just kind of here with his utility belt in his hand. Robin asks if Batman remembers Shaky Reardon, which is the guy that Jayreen's mom's hanging out with, and Batman does. Shaky is apparently a rather prolific scumbag and scammer. Now, this is his only appearance according to the wiki, so I gotta guess that any run-ins he's had with the Batman aren't ones that we have seen. Anyway, the dynamic duo parts company with, I think Batman's climbing into a helicopter. Which seems odd, but okay. Back to the commish. Now, he's hard at work when he gets a phone call from his wife. She reports in that she's in Tricorner taking care of some business, but she's about to grab a boat back to the city. Just then, Renee Montoya enters the scene with some news for Gordon, which we don't get to see just yet. I don't know if it's going to be important, because we don't find out. Anyway, next, we head over to the Glacier Room, one of the Penguin's totally legit establishments. Here, we join Robin, who's got some questions about old Shaky. Now, Oswald isn't immediately keen on sharing any info, but Tim is able to persuade him, pretty much the exact same way Batman did last time. More or less by promising to rain down all shades of hell upon him if he doesn't cough up the information. Over to the docks. Now, it's here where we finally get to see our Gordon and S. and Gordon reunion. And, well, they make out while their fellow officers hoot and holler. Next, we pop over to the ruins of a street and see Shaky and Ms. Gilbert getting ready to, well, leave Gotham. They're escaping Gotham to start a new life. And they've got, they're going to do a lot of credit card fraud type stuff. Robin arrives and asks Ms. Gilbert if she, maybe she's perhaps forgetting something. To which, wow, the horrible woman says that she never wanted to be a mom, still doesn't want to be a mom, and, just tell that no good daughter of hers that she's dead. Well, dang. Now, before hopping into Shaky's hoopty, she asked Tim if Jayreen still carried around a rag doll. Now, Tim kind of, he's taken aback, but says, nope, no rag doll to be found. And, well, the disappointed scumbags leave. Oh, Robin does smash their briefcase full of blank credit cards before they leave. So, kind of a Pyrrhic victory for the Shake Man, though, I mean, he didn't cut the cards up in half or nothing, so they're still there. I don't know. Anyway, we follow Tim back to the GCPD HQ, where he updates Montoya on the mom hunt situation. And Renee, she's disgusted, and rightfully so. It's worth noting, I don't talk about art often. I say that a lot, so maybe I do talk about art a lot. I don't know. But anyway, this is Jim Aparo art. And, dude really seems to be struggling with ponytails this time out. A lot of really bad ponytails here. And Montoya's widow's peak is approaching, like, Namor territory. Like, when I turned the page here, I thought it might be Namor. Not great. Anyway, Robin picks up the ragdoll and unscrews its head. And would you believe it? There's a Jagundis wad of cash in there. Montoya tells him that she'll see if she can track down any of Jayreen's extended family, and just one page later, our last page, Jayreen is with them. We find ourselves on a farm with Jayreen's grandparents. Now she's psyched to be there with all the cows and ducks and whatnot, and she says that she'll stay there till she leaves to go to college. Jayreen tells the grand folks that Robin told her that her dolly would send her to college, and we close out with that ragdoll giving us, the readers, a wink. The old Clark Kent style, back in the ages of old. But that is where we leave it. Next time out, we will be chatting up Shadow of the Bat, number 76. And you know, in all my years of doing this, the same kind of tired format that I use, I still don't think I figured out a fluid way to get from the synopsis to the analysis portion here with, like, I don't know, usually it's like, well, first we'll talk about the... It's very, very disjointed. I'm not very good at this. So, hey, how about we talk about this issue? I thought this was pretty good. It's a nice focus on, like, the non-caped element of Gotham City. I mean, we're kind of brushing up against the search and rescue formula, but kind of in a different way. The little girl lost story was pretty touching, and it facilitated some pretty good character moments. Not just from the Bat set, but it also showed, like I mentioned earlier, a softer side to the GCPD. And, I mean, it's bummer days in Gotham, to be sure, but they're still able to project optimism and positivity when they need to. So, I mean, maybe the visit from Jayreen did as much for them as it did for her. Who can say? Now, the Jayreen story was pretty convenient, but it worked. It worked. I had no complaints about it. It was a nice little aside. Didn't hurt nothing, and like I said, it facilitated some pretty nice character moments. Now, speaking of the softer side of the GCPD, I did enjoy the Gordon Essen reunion. Though, again, I still feel like Hardbach would have told the commish that Sarah had survived the quake. Is there some sort of, like, deep-seated, like, acrimony between the two that I don't know about? Like, did Hardbach want Sarah Essen as a potential mate? I really don't know. Or maybe nobody involved with the main Bat books bothered to read Asriel? Though, when Denny O'Neill's the writer of that, and also the group editor, and that... Oh, okay, yeah, there's no excuse. This was just sloppy, and we'll leave it at that. Really not much more to say about the issue, which I fear might just sort of become the way we do these segments during the Aftershock leg of our journey. I mean, we're kind of in limbo, narratively speaking. We have the big bad event, the Cataclysm happened, and at this point we're just kind of waiting to be ushered into the new status quo. Just so happens we've got like 6 months worth of time and stories to kill before it gets here. Overall, though, a really good, relatively quiet chapter in Gotham's new normal. Now, with the issue discussed, we're going to be skipping the mailbag today because this is something that I had kind of teased at the Facebook group. We're going to be talking about, the article that inspired this story altogether. Now, it's an article from New York Magazine dated December 11th, 1995. The story is called Waiting for the Big One by Fred Graves and Charlie Rubin. Now, I found out about this when I was perusing one of my Tomorrow's books. You guys know I love the Tomorrow's stuff. And I was checking out the Tomorrow's American... It's so weird, you know. I think it's just pronounced Tomorrow's, but since it's Tomorrow's, I always overpronounce or overemphasize the two. So it's Tomorrow's. It's probably just Tomorrow's, I don't know. Anyway, Tomorrow's American Comic Book Chronicles, the 1990s, from Jason Sachs and Keith Dallas. Now, if you've seen these American Chronicles hardbacks, they are they're really cool. They go back to, like, the seminal days of the industry here. I think the first one is, like, 30s and 40s. It's very, very well-done stuff here. And anytime I start a research project or anything that I might be able to add flavor to with any sort of ephemeral discussion, dialogue, whatever. I like to at least skim these books to see if there's anything relevant or anything citable or just anything interesting. And, you know, I've had these books for a few years now. They were Reggie's, which only makes them even more special and helps to make me feel like he's a part of this research still. So that's a really cool bit. So I was looking at the 90s one here, and on page 256, there's a mention of Cataclysm. And it says here, the idea for Cataclysm came from freelance writer-artist Chris Raynaud, who had read an article in New York Magazine which described the unbelievable devastation an earthquake would bring to New York. It was a very frightening article. They made a lot of references to Kyoto, Japan, and the devastating effects the quake had on that city. New York had, in a lot of ways, been built on the premise that there won't ever be an earthquake here. And we will, of course, be going into that article. But first, I do want to wrap up the tomorrow's bit. Quote, with every month, the changes to Gotham seem more and more permanent. As associate editor Darren Vincenzo declared, with Cataclysm, we can't return to the status quo. A story like this will have repercussions for months and years to come. Alan Grant says, it was a bit of a shock, the Batcave being established for such a long time to make it come crashing down. I believe that the other writers felt the same way I did, that we were smashing an icon. Now, it says here that sales were reportedly excellent for the crossover. One retailer in Milford, Connecticut, reported that Cataclysm actually doubled sales on all Bat books. And of course, as I said, we will be following this closely as we get further into the run. Now, onto the article. Now, the little subtitle here is, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but scientists agree a quake is coming and New York isn't ready for it. Before we dig in, a quick disclaimer. I'm going to be quoting a lot from this article because I am not a seismologist nor anything resembling an expert in tectonics or tectonic adjacent anything. Any of my own like off-the-cuff editorializing has absolutely zero bearing in science and does not reflect whether or not I understand what I'm discussing. So I might have some comments here and again, but largely we're going to be summarizing and just discussing what's put here on the paper. Now, the article opens with a reminder of two earthquakes that did hit New York. One happened in 1737, another in 1884. Both were reportedly magnitude 5 quakes, but times were, of course, very, very different. New York City and Manhattan specifically weren't quite what New York City and Manhattan specifically would become, right? Now, They were both in right around the same spot. They emanated in Rockaway. Now, these two quakes happened 147 years apart, and at the time of this article being written was 111 years since the last one. As of right this moment, it's about 140 years hence, so hopefully it's not sticking to any sort of schedule, right? Now, magnitude 5s are a pretty big deal, but for like states like California, they're, you know, relatively speaking, just a blip. The thing of it is, New York, and Manhattan especially, ain't California. Klaus Jacob, who we're going to be hearing from a lot, he's of Columbia's Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory. He says of a potential earthquake registering beyond a 6, he says, quote, nobody knows what's going to happen. A magnitude 6 would probably have the potential to come close to what a 7 did in Kobe, Japan. And if we ever would have a 7 in this area, forget it. I mean, there'll be no Metropolitan Museum, no Museum of Modern Art, no Lincoln Center. So it sounds to me like this potential New York quake is quite the unappreciator of art. Now, Alan Kafka, another guy we're going to be hearing from, he's a geophysicist at Boston College's Weston University. Now, he suggests that it's not out of the realm of possibility, or even probability, for New York to see a magnitude 8. He says, global studies consider the 1811 magnitude quake in New Madrid, Missouri, about the largest intraplate earthquake. Now, do we know anything about the New York City area that says it's any different from any other intraplate areas? Not necessarily. On some level, I'd say the maximum possible magnitude would have to be that big. Now, intraplate, we're going to learn a little bit more about as we move on, but we'll get there when we get there. Now, geologists and seismologists tell us that a magnitude 5 plus earthquake is approximately a 200-year event. A 6 quake is a 600-year event, and a 7 quake is a 2,000-year event. But they say, you gotta ask yourself, 600 or 2,000 years from when? Like, if it's 2,000 years from 2,000 years ago, that's a problem. Worse yet, there's nothing that says a 1,000-year event can't happen in two consecutive years or even twice in 1 year. These are just odds, like any odds. They can work in your favor or they can, I guess, literally crash down on you like tons of bricks. New York City is located in the middle of a tectonic plate, not on the edge of one like California, on a continental rift formed by the separation of the American and European and African continents. A lot of continental drift stuff follows, but our takeaway here is that there's a suture-like geological formation known as Cameron's Line. And this runs through the Bronx, down the East River, past Gracie Mansion, under the Queensboro Bridge, through Staten Island, and all the way down to Charleston, South Carolina. But that's not all. Manhattan's other fault lines can be found running across Dyckman Street in northern Manhattan on an east-west line from Broadway in the 200s through Harlem, to East 125th Street on an east-west line from the Intrepid Museum down to Alphabet City, and on two much older north-south lines, one down the Hudson from 42nd Street into the harbor, and the other along Broadway from the upper 30s through Chambers Street and then into Battery Park. Klaus says, "We have so many faults here in New York from a long geological history that it doesn't matter. It could be any and all of those faults that can go, so we have to decide that an earthquake could occur anywhere." And of course, this is very, very sobering stuff, and maybe before we get much further into it, this is very much, I don't want to say it's a sensationalist piece, but I mean, there is some fear stoking here, for sure. That's not to say that the seismologists that are being interviewed here don't 100% believe that this is something that could and probably will happen. But there's going to be one of the things in this, like in the, I guess, the thesis statement for this article is that they interviewed something like 80 people or over 80 people, and they all had their own agendas. So everything that we read here and discuss here, many, many grains of salt. I mean, these are very well-educated people who know their field. They know what their, you know, their discipline is, but we're trying to sell magazines here too. So just keep that in mind. We're going to take it as we get it here. I'm not making any statements one way or another. We're mostly treating this as food for thought and just the inspiration for the cataclysm story. They do include a map here of Manhattan, which shows where all these fault lines and sutures are. And hopefully I'll remember to post it somewhere when I put this up, but it's a scary bit of business when you look at it that way. You know, taking everything out of the equation and putting this in a vacuum where it's just like, wow, this can shake everywhere. it's sobering. It's scary. Now, the thought among the big brains in the New York seismic community at the time was that the likeliest epicenter of a potential quake will be focused on the Newark Basin. Now, this basin sits between two belts of fault lines that surround New York. The first one's along the Hudson Highlands, which includes the Ramapo Fault. The second encompasses parts of Connecticut, Westchester, and Long Island, down through the city proper and even into central New Jersey. Now, those earlier magnitude 5s we discussed occurred on the eastern belt. Plus, data from a quarter century before this article hit reveals that dozens of small, largely unfelt quakes, magnitude 1 to 3, actually happened here. So these are things that happen. Kafka is quoted as saying, "As a basic seismological statement, where the small earthquakes are illuminates where the big earthquakes are gonna happen. Scientifically, I'm becoming more and more convinced that this cluster of seismic activity around the Newark Basin is because it's an active area. I think it's real." They then go into pretty much the main thrust of the article here, which is a discussion of New York's preparedness. And they start by just talking about another magnitude 5, because we, you know, there were two magnitude 5s there. Stands to reason that another could happen. Again, they state clearly that a New York 5 will be far different than a California 5. Kafka says, "Our population and buildings are packed so densely, our infrastructure is so old, that a New York 5 could easily pack the wallop of a California 6. And the exchange rate is something that's going to stay pretty constant or consistent with the discussions here. When they talk about a California 3, it's a New York 4. It's up one just due to how packed and dense the city is. New York Building Commissioner Joel Meehl, we're going to hear from him a bit here. He says the moderate earthquake could be locally more than moderate. And we get more New York versus California here. As we mentioned, the intraplate and the edge here. California's on the edge of a plate, not intraplate like New York. Now, that means a lot of things. One of the things it means is that there's heat via underground volcanic activity due to the plates rubbing together in California. Now, the hotter the temperature, the more quickly it damps out the propagation of seismic waves, which I assume means that the quake would be more localized in California and not as widespread as an intraplate one could be. Now, New York being intraplate would result in waves traveling in all directions. Now, that's not limited to just the city. Now, even an M5 quake in upstate New York could and potentially would massively affect Manhattan. Remember that 1886 quake we discussed that occurred in Charlton, South Carolina? I think we talked about that during the Wizard Batman special. Well, it says here that that quake was felt in Manhattan. Walls in Harlem cracked during that, and shock waves from Charleston were also felt in Mobile, Alabama, and Omaha, Nebraska. So lots of potential seismic travel in the intraplate regions. But you might be saying, I thought Manhattan was unshakable. Well, I mean, I wouldn't be saying that because I'm not an expert on anything, but so the legend goes. And, well, thing of it is, Manhattan sits on bedrock. But the thing of that is, bedrock is unshakable because it's extremely efficient in transmitting the seismic waves. So if it's not shaken somewhere, it's going to be shaken somewhere else. Now, an unnamed seismologist is quoted as saying, bedrock is better to build on than softer soil. But the five boroughs have a lot of that, too. Places like Flushing, Queens, for example, are described as having the soil of the consistency of jello. Says here, if you're looking for a poor location from a seismic perspective, you would not want to live in Flushing. Also, East Bronx or off Rockaway. Now, Rockaway, of course, is where those fives emanated back in the long ago. It's said here that if you were to go to Howard Beach in Rockaway, out on the peninsula, and if you dig down just 2 feet, you'd find water. Now, this one's for all my quicksand fans out there. We're going to talk liquefaction. The abrupt transformation of soil into fluid by repeated earthquake vibrations. And of course, that is something we've already seen a handful of times in our cataclysm books. Now, in the boroughs, there's a potential for the natural liquefaction problem to mingle with some man-made ones. Now, between 1900 and 1950, the Manhattan waterfront was built up. Klaus suggests that the Manhattan of old was up to one-third smaller than the current state of the island due to dredging and land reclamation. Now that soil, it's posited, would be sandy and loose, below the water table, and would be a prime candidate for liquefaction. On that sobering note, Carl Costantino, a civil engineering professor at City College, cites the following. You go to Brooklyn, around Brooklyn Battery Tunnel. That whole area is reclaimed from the bay from the 1800s on. When they tried to put in a sewer using a vibratory pile driver, they collapsed 4 two-family homes within 2 blocks. Killed a woman. Imagine what an earthquake can do. Now, the seismic community is pretty appalled that entire neighborhoods and economic hubs in New York are still being built on what is essentially loose landfill. And I mean, this isn't uncommon or even strange in practice. Recently, the wife and I visited Boston. It was last fall, and we took one of those like weird duck boat bus tour gimmicks, like where it's like a land-sea vehicle, where you're on like a duck and you go in the water. It's a fun ride. I'd recommend it to anybody interested in American history. You can see a lot of cool stuff. But on that trip there, they pointed out what parts of Boston is landfill. And it was very, very surprising to know that, like, how we, you know, change shape of land. And at the time of hearing that, it felt like a win-win situation. But of course, you know, I'm not a seismologist. I'm not part of any sort of scientific community, so I know nothing. Now, the article then moves into discussion of buildings and construction. It says there's five basic types of construction in New York, but they're only going to really pay attention to two for the purposes of this article. Now, experts agree that the safest kind of building to be in during a quake is the steel frame high-rise. Klaus says, given a choice, I would spend the first 10 minutes of a major quake at the top of the World Trade Center. Again, this was 1995. He continues, I may not even know that it happened, because it may be such a sharp, short jolt that only small buildings feel it. And with this big building up there, the earth underneath will wobble and the top of the World Trade Center will stand still. The riskiest buildings are reinforced masonry, brownstones, and walk-ups. Charles Scawthorne, a researcher, said in a 1988 study, now at the time, this was the only study about a possible quake in New York, which might have to check out somewhere down the line for some supplemental blah blah blah, but right? Now he says, the streets would be filled with bricks, and you'd literally be looking up at the guy in his bathtub. That kind of comic book scene. You'd just have bricks everywhere. Thousands. Tens of thousands. Hundreds of thousands. And that comic booky scene he's talking of, I think we're all familiar with it, right? Like a bathtub on a pipe with like a guy with a rubber duck and a brush. You know, that kind of picture there. Now back to it. New York's more decorative architectural elements are also a danger. Cladding, parapets, arches, Gotham's gargoyles and stuff. Also, more functional pieces like air conditioners, water tanks, interiors having things like staircases, stairwells, elevators. We got a quote here from Barclay Jones, a professor of city and regional planning and science at Cornell. And he says here that you haven't gotten enough elevator repairmen in the entire country to deal with New York City. Now, while still on the subject of dealing with New York City, the 1994 Los Angeles Northridge quake, just 1 year before this piece was published, we pop back over to Joel Meehl, New York's building commish. He talks up engineers having to tag buildings to mark whether or not they're safe to occupy. Green tag, safe. Yellow tag, risky. Only government officials can enter knowing they're taking a risk. Red tag, stay the F away. Per Meehl, he says, unfortunately, our staff is no way in hell going to be adequate to handle it. Again, a New York quake ain't going to be like a California quake. Now, how about we move this article from cataclysm to aftershock? Quake's over and done with, so what now? Well, essential services such as water, electricity, and phones, right? It's said that maintaining these services, even like during the most ideal conditions, is daunting. Post-quake, and with the scrambled mishmash of ancient and modern pipelines underground to deliver those services, well, they're probably going to need a minute. And now 9X Coordinator for Emergency Management Operation, Ted Kozars, he says that they have an emergency plan but would not go into detail due to security concerns. Now, it's suggested in this article that whatever plan this is only planning for up to a magnitude 5 quake. Now, Con Edison is a little bit more forthcoming with their lack of preparedness in the face of such a disaster. An unnamed, for good reason, Con Ed insider says, quote, are we ready? God, no. Do we have a plan? Yeah, and I think they're aware it's kind of a frail one. But what do you tell the New York City population? I'm not ready? Yikes. Now, Con Ed, by the way, in case you don't know, is the electric company. Tom O'Rourke, civil and environmental engineering professor at Cornell, talks a bit about the wet wake of a potential quake. Now, the number of the city's water pipes damaged in just an M5 could run well into the hundreds. On top of just the flooding and loss of usable water to New Yorkers, it's also going to affect the water pressure. And, well, as we've seen in Gotham City, after a quake, there's gonna be fire. Now, fires that won't be able to be fought without adequate water pressure, and we definitely saw that in Cataclysm. And that tells me that this article was used for research and inspiration. That's pretty interesting. Now, a spokeswoman for the New York Department of Water claims that they have a huge redundancy in the water system that they can count on. There are two water tunnels built in 1917 and 1938 that bring the city almost its entire water supply and have never been shut down for maintenance. Our man Klaus says of it, well, according to the article, he actually shouts this part. He says they are in complete denial. They have essentially two supply lines bringing water to New York, and one is already leaking. It happens to be close to a fault where there was once an earthquake, in Wappinger Falls. An upstate quake could wipe out both these tunnels in one stroke. What do we do then? Lay a hose across the Hudson? And, you know, it's like I'm almost thinking that Klaus is rooting for the quake at this point. He's just like, he's so fed up with all these service providers. Rose Downey, head of the New York Fire Department search and rescue team, says, "We could utilize the water from the East and Hudson rivers. We have boats that are capable of pumping for miles and satellite water units that can stretch a hose for miles." And of course, we did see that during Cataclysm as well, when Babs was trying to whoop the GCPD and GCFD in line right after the quake. Now, unfortunately for Ms. Downey, as of this writing in 1995, two of New York's fireboats were up on auction block. So, whoops. And another cherry on the sundae here is that many of New York's firehouses are in unreinforced masonry buildings. So they'd be part of those tens of thousands of bricks left littering whatever's left of the streets. Basically, first responders and emergency services would have to rescue themselves before attending to the city at large. The discussion then turns to hospitals, and a number of key hospitals sit on soil with a greater than 50% probability of liquefaction, with many more sitting on soil with a 10 to 49% probability, so not great. A Bellevue Hospital stands out as being state-of-the-art in that it was designed to far exceed New York City's seismic building code. Though, our man Klaus scoffs at this notion. Again, Klaus, whose side are you on here? He goes on to say about potential post-quake medical treatment, quote, "You will have to go back to medieval military field medicine with butcher knives and hot water and a sponge." This dude's just a beam of sunshine. Now, how's about we talk about the injuries we might expect? We check in with Dr. Louis Goldfrank, the head of Bellevue's emergency room, and he says, "Think of things falling on people, masses of concrete or structures of steel. That means fractured heads, face, chest, abdomen, extremities. Those are the initial wave. Then you have the fires that develop, gas leaks, explosions, burns. Then you have asphyxia associated with lack of oxygen in certain areas. You have people who have carbon monoxide because of the fires. And you have the fumes that lead to respiratory difficulties. Then you have the associated thermal injuries. You have the level of stress that increases on all standard diseases that people already have. Myocardial infractions. You have more people who are anxious, more people who behave strangely, and then ... the crush component." The what now? Well, crush syndrome is a staple of earthquake medicine, and it occurs when a building or heavy object entombs a victim, cutting off circulation to a body extremity. The waste particles in the muscles aren't excreted, tissues destroyed, and the kidneys become compromised. Toxins build up in the leg or arm, and when the appendage is lifted, they flow into the bloodstream. If the person doesn't receive dialysis within a matter of hours, in some cases, the body can poison itself to death. Now, Goldfrank, he says that New York has, or at least had at the time, a scarce few hundred dialysis machines. However, most belong to for-profit centers. There is, or at least there was, no organized plan to make them accessible during an emergency. Yelena Pantelic? You know me in names. Anyway, she was the former assistant director for disaster research and planning at the National Center for Earthquake Engineering Research. Wow, that's a long title. She talks about trapped survivors, citing that they'll be sure to face conditions nobody could have ever foreseen. She says, "What type of survival will people have who are trapped on upper floors of buildings where stairs are not functioning and the elevators have failed? What of office communities? No water, no food, protracted isolation. A day? 2 days? What are these people going to do?" Dr. Robert Scott, a clinical psychologist who specializes in earthquake trauma, which is a specialization that I never realized needed to exist, probably due to what he's about to say, says that New York has the, quote, "it can't happen here" syndrome, which I guess I very much also subscribe to. And he says that an earthquake will shatter the worldview of many a New Yorker. And he cites the most vulnerable to trauma as being small children, the elderly, people with disabilities, people living alone, non-English speakers, illegal aliens, and people who are institutionalized. Now, he discusses the stages of community to be expected in the wake of a disaster like an earthquake. Or I suppose any sort of, you know, world-altering disaster. I mean, many of us were alive for at least one of those. There's shock, of course. Then there's the heroic phase, where, you know, we're community-minded, and we're trying to save everybody. Then there's the honeymoon phase, where I think we just come to appreciate those of us who survived. And then we have the angry phase, which leads to violence and distrust. The, you know, how did we let this happen? How did they let this happen? How did this happen? Sort of phase where, you know, the community aspect kind of falls to the wayside. Now, let's go back to Klaus for a bit, and he's going to talk about prioritization. I don't know why I put words in here, I can't say. Now, he believes that school buildings and armories should be at the top of the list for what to make sure is earthquake ready, since they're the most likely places with enough room and facilities to house many of the victims. Thing of it is, and there always is a thing of it, New York's armories are, or at least were in 1995, made of unreinforced masonry. The 1,100 schools are made of reinforced concrete, however, are quite old and had never been checked for seismic resistance. Now, in the wake of the Kobe, Japan earthquake, then-Mayor Rudy Giuliani asked the Office of Emergency Management to put together a presentation on New York's ability to manage in the wake of such a quake. And, well, the NYPD thinks they can handle it, evidently. The New York Police Department Office for Emergency Management cites how they took care of the World Trade Center as a dress rehearsal for a potential earthquake. Now, this is 1995, so it's not that World Trade Center event. This is likely the 1993 bombing. And this entire portion of the article seems, and I mean, I say this as an ignorant person, but it seems kind of ignorant. And shows the NYPD as being, in my opinion, kind of like way out of their element in talking about what they do in a situation like this. Like, they're talking about, like, temporary morgues. I don't know if they're trying to prove that there's some semblance of an infrastructure in place. I mean, the authors of this piece kind of flipped the script here. They asked the NYPD some, I suppose we can say, rather inconvenient questions. Raising points about, like, how a huge percentage of Manhattan cops don't actually live in Manhattan. So, if bridges, roads, and tunnels get knocked out, what does that mean for the size of the police force? They also asked questions about looting, which evidently wasn't even a concern. An officer named Joe Murphy answered with a very inspiring statement. He says, look, if it affects the five boroughs, then it's over. Back to our man Klaus, who, again, kind of scoffs. He says, they were stretched to their limits in the World Trade Center. The emergency management planning in the city, in the state, and on a federal level for this area is a hoax. Now, some fella named Barney Puglio, who I'm sure has an important title, he disagrees, citing FEMA recommendations and the all-hazards approach, which is basically a one-disaster-fits-all plan, which, to me, as a complete donkey-brained idiot, sounds like a bad idea. I mean, New York City's a different kind of place, right? There are very few, if any, places like it in the country. I think it might need its own sort of action plan. But again, what do I know? Dr. Frank from Bellevue, he shakes his head at this notion here, and he paraphrases the Red Queen from Alice in Wonderland. He says, you gotta believe in one unbelievable thing before breakfast every day. And he cites that that's the way you prepare for disasters. Anyway, let's get back to the hypotheticals here. New York just had a magnitude 6, a California magnitude 6, which hit New York like a magnitude 7. Of course, Gotham was a 7.6, so not, you know, grant that I don't know what the difference is between the decimals in a magnitude, but close, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, we got people trying to get in to help, and people are trying to get out to escape to safety. Question is, how long for help to arrive? Now, rescue pros speak of something called the golden 24 hours, in which it's said that there's a 93% survival rate for those who are trapped. However, after just 72 hours, 95% will perish, or will be assumed to have. We got Bruce Swirin of FEMA, and he says, the first day or two, people should understand that they're on their own. It's unrealistic for people to think that aid's going to be coming in just 6 to 10 hours after the event in any kind of major form. We just can't work that fast. Well, Kevin Krause of SEMA, the State Emergency Management Office, disagrees. He suggests that search and rescue teams could arrive as soon as 8 hours post-quake. Though, it is added here, even if every single search and rescue team in the country arrived, it should be understood that they would barely make a dent. Add to the fact that New York's main airports, Kennedy and LaGuardia, well, they sit on that ripe-for-liquefaction jello soil, so people might not even be able to fly in. Now, Klaus, he talks about lack of airports, lack of bridges and roads, tunnels, and asks the question, how do emergency service get in? Hell, where can even the Navy land to get in? How do people get out? Well, no one can say. It's said here that even something like a visit from the Pope causes insane and unending gridlock. An earthquake would leave New York with streets full of abandoned cars. Now, there's hope that the subway system would survive. There's a citation to a 1985 Mexico City earthquake wherein the subway continued to function. Though, in the more recent Kobe one, well, that one ended with much of the system sinking. Now, New York's subway is weird. It has extensive parts that travel above ground, which, of course, would be vulnerable to all sorts of damage, debris, falling stuff. And, of course, that's assuming that the tunnels don't collapse altogether. Now, Mark Carter of Raymott Associates, a geotechnical engineering firm, talks up how vulnerable the Port Authority's cast iron path tunnels are. He says that they're more brittle than steel and less capable of taking some of the displacement. He actually says, kiss it goodbye. Yeah, then we got, you know, more on tunnels and bridges here. It's said that there's 2,100 bridges throughout the boroughs, which includes overpasses, ramps, subway bridges, and road bridges. It's said here that even if the big suspension bridges survive, they might not be accessible. The, quote, bridge to a bridge, i.e. the approach ramps, would likely face more damage since they're actually part of the landmass that would be shaking. So, okay, we've had a quake, we've had damage here, and, well, the question comes down to what it always comes down to. How much is this going to cost? Now, the going rate at the time in the insurance industry was $1 million per life lost. Carl Costantino says that when he was working for the Atomic Energy Commission, they would place loss of life due to nuclear accidents as $10,000 per body. It's unknown what price New York would place per person. Now, as of this writing, 1995, New York has passed the city's first ever seismic code, which maybe we'll check out somewhere down the line for some side content. I don't know. Well, how good of a code is it? Well, Commissioner Meal says, if you said you wanted to fully protect every building in the city of New York, the answer is you probably never get any legislation passed. There are just too many people who are panic-stricken at the thought of the cost. Now, while this is a step in, I guess, any direction, it doesn't actually change anything in already existing buildings. It doesn't apply to new one- and two-story family homes either. These were apparently concessions included to placate New York's real estate forces in exchange for their support. Well, let's check in on Deborah Beck, the executive director for the New York City Real Estate Board. She denies this with a wacky sort of statement. She says, you know, it's like when you get dressed to go out, in the evening, for something very special. You try to think of all the things that will go with what you want to wear. And then there's the practical reality, what's available in your wardrobe and in your accessories. And while there are many things you might like to have, like a Rolex watch or studs from Cartier if it's a formal event, you know what I'm saying? There are many things that could be added here that would be handsome, but they would be extraordinarily costly enhancements. Yikes. So comparing living in a dwelling that doesn't fall apart when somebody's jackhammering down the road is akin to having a Rolex watch? Yeah, maybe I'm being a little too extreme, but that seems like a very silly sort of statement. Now, this code would likely add no more than 2% of the total cost of new building, but would be much higher if they took to retrofitting older structures. And I mean, again, I know nothing. But it's like, what's the point of building a seismically sound structure next to an already compromised building? I mean, we already saw that play out in during the cataclysm here. Didn't we see Jolene Relazzo's earthquake-proof Wayne Tech building and how it was toppled upon by another nearby non-fortified skyscraper? I don't know. Klaus, our man Klaus here, he chimes in again, and he says that he understands the fear of cost, but says that if New York's seismic buck stops here, it's got to be understood that it'll take decades, even a century, before the slow process of hardening our stock against quakes is in any way meaningful. Seismic Code Committee Chairman Guy Nordenson says, who still doesn't get it? Why, everybody. You've got 8 million people in New York. How many seriously think we've got an earthquake problem? On that note, we hop over to Robert L. King, the director of then-Governor Pataki's Office of Regulatory Reform. Now, he cites a cost analysis and says, quote, if an earthquake is going to cost $100 worth of damage, why should that be prevented with $1,000 worth of work? Which, well, you got me there. You can't argue that logic, can we? Anyway, back to the question of actual costs. Well, we still haven't the foggiest idea. All we got is that 1988 Scawthorne study that we mentioned earlier, during which he recreated the 1884 M5 Plus quake with its epicenter off the shore of Rockaway. Now, the damage estimate in that study was $20 billion, and it only accounts for building stock. So, nothing inside the buildings? Nothing damaged by the resulting fires? No injuries? No deaths? No, quote, agents of damage, unquote. Just the buildings. More from Klaus, who isn't an economist by trade, but apparently enjoys concocting hypothetical economic scenarios. He says, New York's economy tops $1 trillion. Even a 1% loss would hand you a bill for $10 billion. The losses in the 1994 Los Angeles quake topped $30 billion, which is assumed to be a drop in the bucket compared to anything comparable happening in or near Manhattan. The people of New York, much like the people of Gotham City, do not carry earthquake insurance. And, well, if anyone did have the insurance, such an event would cause a cascading effect which would cause scrambling to liquidate assets by the insurance companies, thereby dislocating the market, and would be, you know, not only geographically catastrophic, but financially catastrophic. And on that note, what of the stock market? Well, don't worry about them. They've got a backup plan that they're keeping secret. Though, even a day or two without trading at the New York Stock Exchange would cause an international ripple effect. And it's assumed that it would correct itself due to the, you know, massive influx of cash caused by repairs and whatnot. A lot of spending would have to be done, so the stock exchange would rebound. At least, it's assumed. But what of New York's own economy? Well, if Manhattan is rendered temporarily unlivable, where do the people go? What's more, once the dust clears and dwellings are rebuilt, do those people come back? Maybe not. This takes us to the end here. Klaus closes things out for us, because Klaus has been keeping us company this whole time. He basically says that we're in a foot race with earthquakes. We take our time and earthquakes take theirs. He says, as of this writing, man is lagging behind. He cites the Kobe quake again. And maybe that's one we'll dig into at some point. Now, Kobe had not seen a quake in over 100 years and was woefully unprepared for the one they eventually got. The fires that reduced the city to rubble were fueled by old, shattered gas lines and kept alive when collapsed water lines crippled firefighters. Most of the city's buildings were built before Kobe's real estate community adopted a seismic code. Much of the city rested on landfill, and an inflexible and overconfident chain of command was never ready for the multiple disasters that come along with an earthquake. Relief was hampered by the fact that there were no critical routes, just one road to let refugees out and help in. And in the wake of the quake, the city may never be able to reabsorb its now homeless citizens. The entire piece ends with a two-word, sort of flippant but sort of sobering little statement. It happens. So there you have it. Apologies for going on so long. I just found this very interesting, just as a supplemental piece to look at here. I love finding out the genesis of stories and what inspires writers to write, creators to create. And, you know, the fact that this article led to a very memorable time for one of the most iconic not just comic book characters, but modern literature characters just turned the world upside down and gave us a lot to think about. I love how we can actually see the, you know, the correlation between some of the things that are touched upon in this article, which I'm sure my summary did no justice to. I'm going to try to remember to include this thing on the blog at some point, hopefully tomorrow or today as you're listening to this. But you can check it out at your leisure. That map will be part of it. So it's a lot of interesting food for thought. If you do check it out and see something I missed or misrepresented, please let me know and we can discuss it further. If you want to discuss, well, pretty much anything, please feel free to reach out here. Of course, I can be found all those different ways here. WeirdComicsHistory@gmail.com, Chris is on InfiniteEarths.com, 90s X-Men on Facebook, Ace Comics on Twitter. There's that Blue Sky thing I never went back to, but it's there. Maybe I'll remember to pop back in there eventually. But my eyes and throat are about shot right now, so I will let you all get on with your day. I'd like to thank you so much for listening. If you're still listening at this point, big, big thanks. I hope you found this as interesting as I did. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya.
Makes it harder to think straight, stop.